Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take your sources, really dig in, and pull out those crucial bits of knowledge for you. You know, the stuff that helps you get truly informed fast. Today, we're heading into some pretty unsettling territory, exploring a piece of American lore that, well, it promises to lift the veil on something hidden deep in our history. It's a narrative that definitely challenges our comfortable views on the past and maybe even how pop culture develops. We're looking at how something that seems really innocent, something maybe familiar, could actually have roots in something incredibly dark. We'll be sticking closely to the historical accounts in your materials.
That's right. Our mission today is critical. We need to carefully dissect these primary accounts, these historical records, and set them against this legend that's emerged. We're focusing on what's often called the real Bugs Bunny legend, dating back to 1899. It's a story that's kind of quietly slipped into certain historical conversations. So this deep dive is really about a precise examination, comparing the stark documented history with the enduring, frankly chilling, narrative that's grown up around it. We want to understand how a truly horrific event can get twisted, transformed, and somehow persist as this lingering myth, and our sources lay out this really stark tension right from the start. What some called amusement dressed as tradition versus what was for others, well, a tragic, cruel reality. This tension, this contrast between casual power and profound suffering, it's absolutely central to what we're exploring today.
Okay, let's unpack that. Let's set the scene properly, grounding ourselves in what the sources actually tell us. The materials take us straight to a very specific point in time, 1899. And the place is deep in the Appalachian Mountains of Pennsylvania, rugged country. Now, this wasn't just any old get-together. The records state it happened at a private hunting lodge. And a private hunting lodge, just by its nature, implies, well, exclusivity, doesn't it? A kind of removal from everyday life, from public view.
Exactly. It suggests a secluded space where maybe the normal rules didn't quite apply, or maybe where darker rules could flourish away from scrutiny. It creates an environment, almost a pocket universe, that was ripe for what happened next.
And this exclusivity, as you said, it extended to the people involved, right? The sources are quite specific.
Very specific. They tell us these were wealthy Americans, and they're explicitly named as bankers and factory owners. Now, that's not just a side detail. That naming highlights a really distinct class element. It's crucial for understanding the, you know, the power dynamics here. These weren't just average folks. They represented the peak of industrial era society. People with significant economic clout, social standing, often operating without much check on their power.
So they gathered at this lodge. And the name they used for their activity.
They called it the Rabbit Hunt, which sounds almost quaint, doesn't it? But it's chillingly euphemistic. As we'll see, that name was deliberately chosen to hide a profoundly unsettling truth. It aimed to obscure the cruel nature of their entertainment.
The language itself was part of the deception then, sanitizing something awful.
Precisely. It sets the stage perfectly for this narrative where appearances were designed to completely contradict a brutal reality.
So we have these powerful men hidden away in their private lodge, using this misleading name. The sources then draw this incredibly stark contrast, don't they, between the hunters and the hunted.
Absolutely. It's the foundational conflict of this whole story, the contrast between those who organized and participated, seemingly with glee, and those who were the completely unwilling, incredibly vulnerable targets. It's a dichotomy that just permeates every single layer of this legend. It makes it so much more than just some historical curiosity.
So how do the sources detail this power imbalance? Let's get into the patrons first.
Right. The wealthy patrons. The context is key. This wasn't about hunting for food or for survival. It wasn't even sport in any recognizable way. The sources make it clear. This was designed purely as a spectacle, a kind of elaborate, twisted entertainment just for them, the elite participants.
Which points to that theme you mentioned earlier, spectacle as tradition.
Exactly. It shows how people with immense power, with privilege, can essentially invent and legitimize activities, no matter how cruel or morally bankrupt they are, just by framing them as, you know, custom, an annual event. It really makes you question how morality can get so warped, so eroded under the guise of established practice, especially when those doing it are shielded by their wealth and status.
They could literally create their own reality, their own acceptable behaviors.
Chillingly, yes. They could redefine what was acceptable to suit their own darkest desires, creating this perverse stage just for themselves.
And the victims chosen for this spectacle. The sources identify them as orphan boys. That phrase just hits hard.
It does. That single phrase, orphan boys, it immediately throws into sharp relief their immense vulnerability. The unequal power dynamic here is extreme, and it highlights the, frankly, chilling devaluation of human life, especially for marginalized children back in that era.
These were children without protection, without anyone to speak for them.
Completely. No protection, no voice, no recourse. They were on the absolute fringes of society, often seen as, well, disposable. Their total lack of agency isn't just a background detail. It's absolutely central to the tragedy here.
It forces you to confront a time when the lives of the most defenseless could be treated with such utter disregard.
Yeah, treated as insignificant, reduced to objects for sport. The fact that the perpetrators specifically targeted these children, it says everything about their callousness, their exploitation of the most vulnerable.
And this dehumanization wasn't just about their status. It was made physical, literal, through what they were forced to wear. What did the sources say about these so-called costumes?
The dehumanization was explicit, meticulously planned, it seems. The records give chillingly precise details. These boys were forced into burlap suits. And get this, ears stitched high, hoods so tight they could barely see.
Barely see. That's horrifying.
It wasn't just about disguise. It was a deliberate act, calculated, profound dehumanization. The goal was to transform these children, these individuals, into just rabbits. Props, interchangeable objects for the hunter's twisted game.
Stripped of their identity, literally encased as the animal they were supposed to mimic.
Yes. And then there's the added detail. They were driven barefoot into frozen brush.
Barefoot.
Yeah.
In the cold Appalachian terrain.
Exactly. It just underscores their extreme vulnerability, the deliberate cruelty of the conditions they faced, the complete disregard for their basic comfort or well-being. Just imagine the terror. Navigating that harsh terrain, barely able to see, freezing cold, knowing you're being hunted, it was a systematic stripping away of their humanity.
Leaving them exposed, terrified, ready for the hunt to begin.
Precisely.
As we go deeper into this, the scale of the cruelty just becomes clearer and clearer. The sources describe preparations that weren't just for a chase, but for psychological terror, for degradation. What does this tell us about the hunter's mindset?
Well, the sources paint this vivid but deeply disturbing picture of the moments before the chase even started. Acts of profound psychological torment alongside the physical hardship. For the hunters, the scene is described with rifles and lanterns and the detail that they were drunk on whiskey.
Drunk? So this is like a party for them.
It emphasizes that casual, almost festive or celebratory nature of the event for the perpetrators, treating this horrific act like it's just recreation, fueled by alcohol, which, you know, would only blur moral lines further.
Creating this grotesque contrast, a party for the powerful, terror for the children.
Exactly. And those lanterns, usually a symbol of safety, right, or guidance, here they become part of this ominous scene, illuminating the path to terror, not away from it, bobbing in the dark like, as the source says, cruel stars, harbingers of malice.
And the cruelty wasn't just general. The sources highlight a very specific personal act of torment against one child, Thomas. Nicknamed Bunny because of his teeth.
Yes, that detail is particularly sickening. A specific, targeted cruelty. The sources state a carrot was jammed between his jaws, a joke for the hunters.
A joke? Jamming a carrot in a terrified child's mouth.
It wasn't just about incapacitating him or some crude attempt to make him look more like a rabbit. It was deliberate humiliation, mockery, designed to strip him further of his identity, reducing him from a child to an animal. A living prop in their dark theater.
Forcing him to embody the creature they were about to hunt. A final cruel flourish.
Absolutely. Imagine the terror, the degradation, your breath steaming in the cold, forced to participate in your own debasement like that.
And the psychological impact. The source says he was chewing the carrot to keep from crying. That's just devastating.
It's profound. Difficult to really grasp. Chewing to keep from crying. His breath steaming in the cold. It speaks volumes about his desperate internal struggle, trying to hold on to some shred of composure, maybe deny his tormentors the satisfaction of his tears, even as he's trembling from cold, fear, sheer indignity.
A chilling kind of forced performance.
Yes.
His survival instinct tied to enduring this mockery, for a child to suppress that primal terror. It just underscores the absolute depth of the cruelty here. He wasn't just physically attacked, he was psychologically tormented.
Battling the cold, the hunters, and his own overwhelming fear. Heartbreaking.
Gentil.
And then came the dogs. Releasing the hounds, that must have just escalated the terror exponentially. Made it primal, visceral.
Absolutely. It was a deliberate amplification of terror, turning an already horrific scenario into something merciless, inescapable. And the imagery the sources use here is striking. Lanterns bobbed like cruel stars. It adds this visual, almost surreal layer of horror.
Lights that should mean safety become signals of the hunt.
Exactly. Beacons of malice dancing menacingly in the dark, signaling the relentless approach of this pursuit, both human and animal, driving the children deeper into that frozen, unforgiving wilderness. The fear must have been overwhelming.
Which brings us to maybe the most startling point in this whole deep dive, a detail that echoes far beyond this single awful night. The sources record a specific phrase used that night. What's up, Doc?
Yes. And crucially, the sources add that laughter followed this taunt from the dark.
Laughter. After saying that to a terrified child being hunted, this connection is central, isn't it, to what the sources call the origin myth of a catchphrase.
It's profoundly unsettling because here you have this phrase, globally recognized now, the catchphrase of a clever, wisecracking cartoon rabbit, originating potentially in this horrific context as a cruel, mocking jest.
Delivered in a moment of ultimate vulnerability.
Exactly. Designed to amplify terror, humiliation, to mock these children dressed as rabbits by addressing them in a way that cemented their dehumanization. This moment, as described in the records, it just lays bare the chilling possible provenance of an idiom that's become part of playful American culture.
It forces us to confront that idea that seemingly innocuous bits of our culture might have roots in profound human suffering.
It really does. It makes you pause, doesn't it? Suggesting that something so ubiquitous, so apparently innocent, might have this incredibly dark genesis. It invites us to question how these cultural idioms take root, how they evolve, the unseen layers beneath the familiar, a chilling potential seed, indeed.
But we need to be careful here, right? The sources present this connection, but tracing a direct line is difficult.
Yes, and this is where we need that careful hedge. Tracing the direct and sole lineage of a popular phrase from one specific, obscure historical incident to widespread use. While that's often complex, it's rarely a straight line. There are gaps, other influences, interpretations change over time. Historical connections like this are often messy, undocumented fully.
Okay, so it's not a definitive this caused that.
Not definitively the sole cause, but what this incident does provide, undeniably, is a chilling and very potential root. A context that fundamentally shifts how we might hear that phrase. It compels us to consider that cultural touchstones might carry these echoes of trauma, even if those echoes are forgotten or interpreted.
So this incident, documented in our sources, frames What's Up, Doc as a taunt born of terror. That recontextualization alone is powerful.
Immensely powerful. It's a stark reminder of how easily cultural memory can, perhaps unintentionally, whitewash or simply forget the traumatic origins of its own language.
So after this brutal chase, the fear, the degradation, those terrifying taunts, what was the end result for Thomas?
Yeah.
And by implication, for the other boys, the sources are grimly clear.
Yes. The historical record, taken directly from your sources, provides a stark, unvarnished resolution. It paints a picture of just merciless pursuit leading to a tragic discovery. The sources really emphasize the relentless nature of it all, they note. Each time Thomas stumbled, the bark of hounds mixed with voices from the dark.
No escape, no pause, just constant terror.
Exactly. It highlights the complete lack of reprieve, the suffocating fear, and the sheer brutality of a chase that wasn't about sport, it was about domination. Cruelty. There was no chance, really. He was being hunted to exhaustion by men, by dogs, until his young body just gave out.
And the discovery of his body. The sources give specific heartbreaking details about how he was found. Not by the hunters, right?
Right, not by the hunters. The sources detail the discovery by workers, likely local people, separate from that wealthy group at the lodge. He was found in a shallow burrow, skin torn, half a carrot still clenched between his teeth.
Half a carrot.
Yeah.
Still clenched. That detail is just incredibly poignant.
It is almost poetic in its awful symbolism. That half carrot becomes this potent final symbol, not just of the cruel joke they played on him, but maybe of his own desperate, enduring struggle, trying to survive, even in his last moments.
Clinging to life, even while holding the symbol of his torment.
It's a testament to that basic, visceral fight for life against impossible odds. It just strips away any pretense of this being a game. It reveals only profound struggle and suffering.
And the place he was found, a shallow burial. What does that suggest?
Well, shallow burrow implies something hasty, undignified perhaps. Certainly not a proper burial. A stark contrast to the luxury and privilege of the hunting lodge and its patrons.
It speaks volumes about the aftermath, about the perpetrator's indifference.
It really does. It suggests they just left him. Exposed, uncared for. And the fact that it was workers who later found him is significant too. It underlines that class divide again, not just in the act itself, but in the callous aftermath. The wealthy hunters move on, the working class discover the grim evidence.
It points strongly towards a cover-up, or at minimum, just a profound disregard for his life.
Exactly, a profound disregard. And while Thomas's story has these specific, harrowing details in our sources, we have to remember he was likely one of several boys there. His documented fate stands as this chilling example of the wider horror endured by all those defenseless children caught in that cruel spectacle. Their vulnerability, their dehumanization.
So this deep dive, based squarely on these historical accounts, it really forces us to confront some uncomfortable truths about power, tradition, how history is remembered, or how it's forgotten. It's such a powerful example of that tension you mentioned, legend versus record. The sparse facts of something horrific slowly morphing into something else, losing their sharp, painful edges.
Yes. And this specific incident, it resonates with broader themes we often see when looking at historical narratives, drawing on wider patterns.
Like those themes of class cruelty and spectacle as tradition. Let's revisit those. For the men, it was amusement dressed as tradition, a sanctioned outlet for cruelty.
A ritual they created out of suffering. And for the children, as the source darkly puts it, a costume stitched for death. That juxtaposition is chilling. It shows how tradition can be twisted to legitimize barbarity, especially against the most vulnerable, those with no power to resist.
It forces you to ask, what is tradition really, and who does it actually serve?
Exactly. Often, what looks like time-honored custom is really a mechanism for the powerful to assert dominance, indulge darker impulses without consequence, hidden behind the idea of tradition. It's a powerful indictment of how status can warp morality, rewrite the rules of acceptable behavior, make the unimaginable seem permissible.
And then there's that mind-bending part about the origin myth of a catchphrase. What's up, Doc? How something so light, so iconic, could potentially stem from such darkness. It really challenges how we think culture works.
It's a fascinating, if unsettling, process of transformation. How a taunt born of malice could somehow, through cultural drift, reinterpretation, maybe even just coincidence, get completely detached from its original awful context and then become imbued with new, playful meaning. It says so much about how fickle cultural memory can be, about appropriation, linguistic evolution.
From a mythologist's view, is this a common pattern? Dark roots for common symbols or phrases.
It is. Myths and folklore often have these dark, forgotten origins, or they're built on reinterpretations of trauma. The initial cruelty, the specific history, often gets buried under layers of narrative, smoothed over by time, leaving just a surface phrase or symbol stripped of its original menace to float into popular culture, recognized by millions who have no idea of the grim provenance. It's a constant cycle, really, often replacing unpleasant truth with something more palatable.
Which brings up that question about the legacy of erasure in folklore. How many similar events are buried? Horrors involving the powerful and the vulnerable, only resurfacing as distorted legends or these strange cultural echoes.
It's a profound question, and this incident is such a stark example of erasure. We talk about this concept where the very act of trying to suppress something horrific or just letting it be forgotten for decades paradoxically makes the rediscovered pieces even more powerful. Mm. They become these persistent whispers that won't stay silent. The gaps in the record, the silence itself speaks volumes. It almost leaves this phantom limb of memory.
A trace remains, even if the full memory is suppressed, like our concept of arrested time. The official record might freeze or hide the event, but the cultural memory, maybe a phrase, an image keeps moving, evolving, warping.
Precisely. While records can freeze, the underlying impact on lives, and therefore on culture, keeps moving. The artifacts of memory that taunt, the rabid imagery they can outlive the direct, painful memory of where they came from, subtly influencing generations who are completely unaware of the trauma that might have spawned them. History isn't just what's written. It's what echoes.
And this whole rabbit hunt, it really feels like a prime example of a false game, doesn't it? The rules are just completely rigged from the start.
It's a perfect, horrifying example. A false game where the rules are manipulated entirely by those in power. The outcome is tragically predetermined for the vulnerable. This wasn't about fairness or competition. It was a charade. The hunters had all the advantages. Yes. Weapons, darkness, safety, alcohol. The prey, barefoot, hooded, driven into the cold, were stripped of everything.
The outcome wasn't chance. It was engineered.
Absolutely. Engineered by the very design of the hunt. A chilling demonstration of how systems can be twisted, not for sport, but for exploitation, dehumanization, and guaranteed victimization. Power constructing its own brutal reality.
This deep dive has certainly pulled us into a disturbing, thought-provoking corner of history. It forces us to face a narrative much darker than the cartoon we associate with What's Up, Doc?
Mm.
It's a chilling reminder, isn't it? That the stories we tell, the traditions we keep, even the innocent phrases we use, they can carry these profound echoes of forgotten tragedies, resonating from beneath the surface.
It fundamentally challenges us, you know, to look beyond the seemingly harmless surfaces of our culture, to critically question where familiar things actually come from, what they imply. What really stands out for me is that stark contrast the sources give us. Amusement dressed as tradition versus a uniform stitched for death. That leaves you with a lot to think about.
Right.
About power, memory, human nature itself.
It really does. As our deep dive into these unsettling sources comes to a close, we're left with this stark image. It wasn't explicitly laid out moment by moment in our main discussion, but it built powerfully on the themes, the details. Just picture it. A single half carrot, lying in the fresh snow. And in the distance, the cruel glow of those lanterns finally starting to fade as dawn breaks.
That is a potent symbol. Indelible, really. A symbol of a life cut short, of that cruel joke ending in tragedy, and of a horrific event being slowly obscured by time, by the falling snow, by the dimming light of memory itself. It makes you consider how such images, even if not perfectly documented, can still resonate, endure, sometimes just subtly, in our collective consciousness. It prompts us to keep asking, what else lies beneath the surface of the stories we think we know? What else is waiting to be uncovered?